This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Jim Calbreath on the 28th of November, the year 2001, at approximately 7:40 Lubbock time. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Calbreath is in Bothell, Washington. Sir, why don't we begin by discussing briefly your early life, and if you would, tell us when and where you were born and where you grew up.
Okay. I was born in Oakland, California, January of 1947. Excuse me. My family was originally from Idaho. Both of my parents were raised up here in the wheat country. Then from there, my dad just kind of liked to move for lack of any other possible explanation. I went to a lot of different schools, moved around a lot. When I finally graduated from high school, that was my 12th school. Anywhere from Idaho to California to Tennessee and back to Washington again.
Well, how did that affect you as far as moving around a lot? Was it, did it make it difficult to make friends, or did it make you more amiable? You know, what was the effect of that having?
Actually, it made me better able to deal with any group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I've always considered that a good thing.
Uh-huh.
Because I can pretty much get along with anybody.
Okay.
So it was very positive for me.
Mm-hmm.
The downside is, and also the upside is, that you don't really have a home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the Army, everybody always says, "Where are you from?" And I would always turn it around and say, "Well, where are you from?" And then I'd say, "Hey, I used to live there."
Okay.
Anyway, you know how that goes.
Yeah. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Mm-hmm. Okay. There were five of us kids.
Wow.
Uh-huh. I was the youngest of five.
Okay.
My sister was the oldest, and then there was four boys.
Okay. Now, did moving around, do you think that strengthened the bond between you and your brothers and sisters?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because we had to take our own friends with us.
Yeah. Okay. What did your dad do principally for work?
My dad was probably his two main careers were farmer,
mm-hmm,
and airplane mechanic.
Oh, wow.
So.
Okay.
A bit of a variety there.
Yeah. And your mom, did she work as well, or?
Not too often. When things got really tough, she would go to work. Hers was, she did a lot of electronics assembly.
Oh.
So she could always get her a job fairly quick.
Okay. Well, as you were growing up, for instance, in high school, what did you find most interesting? What subjects did you like?
I liked the sciences. When I was a sophomore in high school, I had a really amazing biology teacher, one of those people who has no idea of the number of lives that they've touched. Anyway, he was a treat, and he got me started in the sciences. Looking back, I found that I had always enjoyed science, but he really got me turned on, so to speak.
Okay. No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And then also athletics. I was a football player in,
mm-hmm,
high school.
Mm-hmm. Did you like any other sports or play any other sports in high school?
I did some track for a while, but mm-hmm, that was about all.
Okay. Now, so when you graduated from high school, would you? First of all, when was that? Where were you?
Okay.
What were your plans?
I graduated from high school in 1966. A little town in Middle Tennessee called Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N. My plans at that time, I knew that I had to face the draft. You know, at that time you didn't have many choices. You either got married or went to college or went into the service. My thought was that if I'm drafted, then they get to choose what I want to be, and that didn't sound good. I was interested in clinical laboratory. I found out that the Army had a program where if you gave them an additional year, you could choose your field. So what I did is I said, well, okay, then I want to go into the medical field, into laboratory specifically. And I enlisted for 3 years. And that was September of 66.
Okay. As you were nearing your graduation, or maybe, I guess, during your junior and senior in high school, how aware of the Vietnam War were you?
Not much. Not much. We knew there was a war going on, and we knew that that's why we were all getting drafted.
Mm-hmm.
But the details of the war, we had no idea. You know, as kids, we were interested in, and the we I'm using as my classmates, you know, we weren't interested in things like that.
Mm-hmm.
What we were interested in was, you know, the girl down the street and the fast cars and just being teenagers.
Right.
We had no concept of what was on our horizon.
Mm-hmm. Were politics much discussed around the dinner table?
None.
Okay. And did your father talk to you at all about being drafted or volunteering?
No.
Okay. Did he? Did your father serve in Korea or in World War II?
No, he did not.
Okay. How about any other relatives that you knew?
I had an uncle mm-hmm. who was in World War II,
mm-hmm.
And he wasn't a good role model. Uncle Don was a heck of a nice guy, but, you know, he had come back, looking back upon it as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
But we all knew as kids that he was pretty weird.
Mm.
You know, he was just... He was weird. He was quite a drunk, and he always had a gun with him and this kind of stuff. Looking back, I know what it is now, but at the time, you know, we had no idea what it was. We just knew he was kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
Nice guy, heck of a sweetheart, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, just a little weird.
When you say looking back now, you know what it was.
Yes.
Was it related to his war experience?
I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe it was. And then also he had been career Army, which, you know, for his, and he was infantry, he was
mm-hmm.
airborne.
Mm-hmm.
So all through the Army, he was involved in weapons and weapons training and all this good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I never did hear, nobody would ever talk about what he did during Korea, but I know he was in that area at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't, you know, I don't, you know, family secrets or
okay.
nobody bothered to tell or nobody knew or what, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is we never found out.
Did he ever talk with you about his experiences in the military?
Nope.
As you were nearing your graduation or even afterwards?
Nope.
Okay.
I went and saw him when I was in my advanced training.
Mm-hmm.
He was down in someplace in Texas there by Fort Hood,
mm-hmm.
whatever that is. So probably quite familiar to your current territory.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I went and saw him, spent a weekend up there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I was in my advanced training and probably had about a year, year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't really say much.
Okay. Did you know any other young men who went to Vietnam and either came back or maybe didn't as you were nearing your graduation?
No.
Okay.
I did not.
Okay. Well, when you went to enlist,
mm-hmm.
Did you suspect that you'd probably be going to Vietnam?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did you think was happening over there?
My idea of war was based upon television and movies.
Okay.
And I figured that if I ended up in a hospital, that would be okay. I wouldn't be a frontline medic or anything like that. And that was part of my decision behind joining for 3 years,
mm-hmm.
was that I didn't want to be a warrior. I didn't want to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
If I had to go to Vietnam, which I figured I was going to,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to go and do something that would keep me as safe as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That much I knew.
Yeah. Well, okay, so when you went to the recruiter,
mm-hmm.
how did you secure this particular MOS?
Well, what I did is I went in and I told him that I had an interest in clinical laboratory. He opened up the great book of MOSs and leafed through it, and he says, there you go right there. And he read the brief description, and I said, yep, that's what I want to try. So he signed me up.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called a 92B20.
Did you have to take any kind of exams to see if you had the aptitude to be a lab tech?
Yes.
Okay. And obviously you passed them.
Yes, I did.
Okay. Well, all right, so when did you actually leave home and go off to the Army?
I left. Two questions there. I graduated from high school in May of 66.
Mm-hmm.
knew what I had ahead of me, so I set out to have a grand time.
Oh, okay.
I had family in California. I had family in San Diego and the Bay Area, and so I just took off. And I took buses, and I spent about 3 months just kind of seeing the sights, doing all those things that you're supposed to do as a young man. And then in September of 66, I got a notice that I was supposed to report for my physical in Nashville. And I said, okay. And I had been in contact with the recruiter. I would spend 2 or 3 weeks out, and then I'd come home. My parents were here in Seattle at the time. And when I would come home, I would go down and talk to the recruiters. So I had taken all the tests. I had all the papers. I just didn't have an enlistment date. I had a couple of possible dates. And then when I got my letter that said, report to your to Nashville for your physical, then I went down and signed the papers.
Okay. What did your parents think when you came home and told them you were going, you had volunteered to go in the Army for 3 years?
My mom didn't like it. She knew that there was a war going on. And she was very concerned that I would end up like Uncle Don. It was her brother-in-law was Uncle Don. And that was one of her concerns. My parents felt badly because we didn't have the money for me to go to college. You know, and I was very open with them. I says, you know, these are my choices. And I wasn't raised to go to jail. I wasn't raised to evade the draft. I wasn't raised to go to Canada. You know, it just wasn't done in our family at that time. So going to school wasn't an option. Besides, I wasn't ready. You know, I was 19 years old. My whole idea of life was having fun. I wasn't ready to go to college. I'd have flunked out in 3 months short. You know how that is. And so going into the Army was my only real choice.
Okay. Well, what about your older brothers? What had they done after graduating from high school?
My oldest brother had gotten married right away and had children. So that took care of him. My brother Michael, who was my next older, he joined the Air Force right away, right after high school. And then Brother David, who was the next closest to me, he had been with us in Tennessee, and he was drafted in Tennessee. And ended up being drafted into the Navy, of all things. So at one time, I was in the Army, Brother Michael was in the Air Force, and Brother David was in the Navy. Somewhere there's a family picture floating around. But anyway.
So did they ever serve in Southeast Asia as well?
No.
Okay.
Brother Michael in the Air Force was a dental technician. He was in North Dakota or South Dakota. I don't remember where it was. He was someplace up in the Dakotas from the time he finished his advanced training to the time he got out. Brother David, because he was a draftee, had a 2-year Navy stint. He went to firefighting school, a Christ crew. And then they sent him to Maryland, and he spent his last year and a half there in Maryland. So they both got real lucky.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe your introduction into the Army? You know, where did you go for your basic training? What were your first experiences getting off the bus, so to speak?
Okay. Went down to the induction center here in Seattle. Got in line, held up my hand. They put us on a bus to the airport, Fort Polk, Louisiana. And luckily, I had been living in the South prior to coming to Seattle, because by this time it was September of 66, still real hot, very humid, very hot. So everybody goes to the airport. I think there was 10 or 15. 30, who knows how many in this group, get on buses, go to Fort Polk. The bus pulls up in front of the induction center, and this very nasty man got on this bus and just scared the shit out of all of us. he told us this, and he told us that, and he told us this, and he told us that a couple of times over. It was scary. You know, I had never really been away from home. I had spent that summer kind of playing from point A to point B, but, you know, I was always going from my brother's house to my sister's house or a high school friend's house or something like that. So I'd never really been on my own. And now all of a sudden here's this guy that is just, you know, he is right there in your face, and it's serious. You know, it's not play. This is not the movies. Then they marched us from point A to point B, shaved our heads, which is always everybody's favorite memorable moment. I remember getting a bunch of uniforms, and I'm thinking, God, these are, you know, this is serious. That's when it really hit me. It was not so much in head shaving, because everybody does that, but it was when I had this stack of uniforms. And that's when it really hit me that I was far, far away. And then basic training, after about the first couple of weeks, I kind of figured it out. It was very much like the start of football practice. You know, a lot of running, a lot of people yelling at you, doing things that you've never done before. I was still physically fairly fit, so the exercise component wasn't that bad. I was used to the heat and the humidity, and that wasn't too bad. Most of the other people there at Fort Polk in our particular company were from the Northwest or Northeast. So they had pulled a lot of Northerners down to this basic training in Louisiana. It was, I don't know, I just thought a little too much like a game, you know. I knew where I was going. I knew what I was going to be doing. So I wasn't really concerned about learning bayonet training. I figured the closest I'd ever get to a bayonet was that particular day right there. And I was right. I never did use a bayonet. So basic was not as serious for me as it probably was for others. The advanced training was quite interesting. Like I said, I had always liked sciences. After basic, I went to Fort Sam Houston, which is down in San Antonio. I went through a 16-week training course there. The first part of it was medic training so that you would know what to do should you end up in the field. And then from there, I went through the laboratory training. And that was good. That was quite interesting because it was all new. I had never seen most of the stuff before, and so it was fun to learn. It was great. I enjoyed the advanced training.
Okay. Well, what was the most challenging part of basic training for you?
The most challenging part was the physical side. I was physically fairly fit, but even still, it's a lot of work. So the physical side of basic training, and then also you're alone. It's the loneliness side. It's scary.
Mm-hmm.
The homesickness.
Mm-hmm.
You're homesick.
Okay. And what were the most memorable experiences you had in basic training?
I think there was a guy, I don't remember where he was from, but he just didn't get it. You know, he just flat out didn't get it. He just wasn't very bright. He wasn't coordinated. He couldn't process fast enough to do what he was supposed to do when they told him to do it, which meant he was always, you know, doing extra push-ups. He was always getting yelled at. He was always in trouble. And he had these big, thick glasses, Coke bottle glasses. And so about halfway through, they sent him off to get his army glasses. And when he went in, the story that he told us when he got back was they said, "What the hell are you doing here? You are legally blind. You should not be in the Army." And he said, "Well, when I was in the induction center, that's what they told me, and they told me to go get in that line over there." Well, it turns out that when he was in the induction center, he got in the wrong line. So instead of being declared 4F and not having to actually be inducted into the Army, he was in the wrong line. He went through the entire process. They drafted him. But it was just that he was in the wrong line. So he got the last laugh. He got to go home, and the rest of us stayed there. So I enjoyed that. I thought it was hilarious at the time.
Yes, sir.
I don't remember why. Mm-hmm. It's an Army story. The downside was that there were suicides. There were no suicides in our particular company, but the company down the street had two successful suicides and at least one or two or three or four attempts. It was pretty scary. And that's pretty, you know, we're all a bunch of 18, 19-year-old kids, and now all of a sudden people are dying. It'll make you stop and think. So that had quite an effect on me.
Yes, sir. Any idea why they committed suicide?
They couldn't do it, couldn't handle it, couldn't get out. They didn't know what else to do. You remember what it was like. You know, you're far away from home, mm-hmm. you don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Your outlook for your immediate future is that you're going to go to war. All you want to do is go home. You're miserable.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go home. So you got to get out of there some way. So
right.
You know, somebody else did it. So you do it too.
Yes, sir. And how would you evaluate the drill instructors who trained you in basic?
They were actually quite good. Fully respected. They worked us hard, but there wasn't any chicken shit stuff. You know, they treated us as people. They had very high standards. They worked us hard. They didn't take any guff. They didn't, you know, this was not playtime. You're here for a purpose, and we're damn serious at training you to be the best soldiers you can be. All of them were veterans. Some of the guys were veterans of Bay of Pigs. Some of the younger cadre were Vietnam veterans, but they all had patches on their right shoulder.
Okay. So, did they talk much about their Vietnam experiences?
Not much. You know, they would say, okay, when you get over there, you're going to have to know how to do the bayonet, so I'm going to show you what the Army wants me to show you. And oh, by the way, if you ever really get into that close of a fight, here's how you use a bayonet. You know, you just swing that rifle like it was a baseball bat.
Hmm.
But, you know, not really sit around and shoot the shit and tell the stories. And,
mm-mm.
You know, I was here and we did this. That wasn't the kind of relationship we had.
Right. But obviously there was there was a way that they were supposed to train you, and then there was how things would be realistically.
Yes, very much so.
Was there anything else that sticks out in your mind as far as the training, where that dichotomy existed?
No.
Okay. Well, what was it like going to Fort Sam Houston, and what were the biggest differences in terms of the structure of your training?
The biggest difference was the freedom. In basic, every hour you're very much controlled from the time you get up to the time you go to bed. And in advanced training, you now have freedom. It's you go to class during the day. You have a certain amount of work to do in the evenings. But once you've got that work done, then you're off to be a person. So you can go to movies. You can go talk on the phone anytime you want. You can have a part-time job. So it was freedom. Was the biggest difference. The other difference was respect. I didn't feel like I was the dirt stuff you pick out between the cracks on the floor. Excuse me. But the instructors that I had in advanced training, they were not, this wasn't about war.
Mm-hmm.
This was about doing your job.
Okay.
Learning how to do the things that you're going to need to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it wasn't war footing, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Well, for this, and again, the specific, I guess, identifier for the school is you're becoming a medical lab technician?
Correct.
What was it in that training? How did they start you off in terms of trying to educate you on what you'd be doing?
Well, the first thing they did is divide us up in twos and have us draw blood from each other. And then what they were trying to teach us to do was to be able to do the tests that we would be called upon to do to see whether or not a person has a huge blood loss.
Okay.
Measure total volume of blood. To be able to look at a blood specimen under the microscope and tell whether we're talking about a bacterial infection, a viral infection, malaria, certain different types of parasites. Spent a lot of time on that. Blood chemistries, where you're going to look at the blood and divide it into components and learn how to do a liver enzyme study to see whether or not the person has hepatitis. Blood sugars, looking for diabetes. Things called electrolytes. When a person has been doing a lot of bleeding and getting a lot of IVs and have had burns or dehydration, the metals in your blood, sodium, potassium, chloride, those things can't change very much or you get very, very sick very, very quickly. So we learned how to test for those components. And then we learned how to do it all very, very basic. You know, it was pretty darn basic medicine. We didn't learn the fancy stuff. All we knew is that when you looked at white cells, for example, there were these five or six basic kind of white cells.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned to identify those and tell what percentage of what was in that specimen.
Mm-hmm.
But when I did this later on in life, I found out that in each of those five, there are subfamilies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's actually 25 or 30 different types of white cells you're looking for. We learned to look for five or six or seven, something like that. So it was basic because we weren't there that long. We were there for like 16 weeks. That's not much time.
No, it's not. When you said that one of the first things you did was draw blood from each other, so was this going to be one of the primary things you were going to be doing, and that is basically phlebotomy? Going in, getting blood, processing that blood, doing tests, running tests on it, things like that.
Yep.
That was your MOS.
Yep, that's what I was going to do.
Okay. Let's see. When you talk about the training that you received as far as identifying bacteria and virus, was there any specific focus, or was it kind of like a shotgun approach?
It was a shotgun. It was very basic. This is the type of stain that you do. The basic stain is called a Gram stain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is how you do a Gram stain, period. We didn't spend much time on bacteriology, nothing on virology, because it was such a complex science.
Mm-hmm.
And we just didn't have the time. We learned. I had never seen the Petri dishes, the blood auger plates. I hadn't seen those enough to really look at them and work with them until I got to my first assignment.
Hmm.
We just didn't have time.
How about using microscopes, things like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of microscopes.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of spectrophotometers where you're measuring density or color of liquids at different wavelengths. A lot of microscopes.
While you were there, was there much discussion about, well, of course, in Vietnam, one of the big problems was venereal disease.
Mm-hmm.
So did you guys focus on that at all?
Yes, we did.
Okay. Now, there's, of course, for some venereal diseases, there are somewhat interesting ways that you have to gather specimens. Did you have to go through that as well?
No.
Okay.
No. For those specimens, we, as lab techs, we didn't gather those. That's what the nurses and the doctors did.
Okay.
Or we'd hand a kid a glass slide and say, okay, go on into the bathroom there, and this little exudate that you have coming out of there, put a little of that on that slide.
There you go.
So.
Okay. And let's see. How about drug testing? Was that discussed yet?
Nope.
Okay.
None.
Was that something you eventually did have to deal with?
Not in the Army.
Okay. Let's see. And what was the most challenging aspect of this training for you?
Oh, it was hard. there was an amazing amount of information that you have to remember. It was just a huge amount of information. Rote memorization was never my strong point, so I really had to work hard at it. It was hard work. Just remembering the details. When I talk about the blood chemistry tests, I have an entire textbook that covers just blood chemistry. You know, there might be 50 different tests that we would be responsible for. You have to know what the ranges are, what's the values. If this particular test is elevated, what do you expect that particular test to be? So there was an awful lot of fact. And it was tough getting all that down.
Okay. Well, how well prepared for your three-year tour in the Army did you feel after finishing basic and then AIT?
Not very.
Uh-huh.
Not very. Because I didn't really learn how to be a lab tech until I got back up here to Fort Lewis. I knew the basics. If they would have sent me off to a hospital where I would have had to have stood alone and done this by myself, I'd have killed a lot of people. I just wasn't quite prepared.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too huge of a science.
Mm-hmm.
You can learn the basics, but to actually be competent, to be capable, it takes time.
Mm-hmm.
Because the procedures we were doing were so, they were very complex.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of places to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, if you made a mistake, you wouldn't really know about it. In the Army at that time, we had no concept of quality control.
Mm-hmm.
You just did the test. And if it came out to be a number that looked realistic, it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have a control serum to run along with it. So we were doing the best we could.
Right.
But I wasn't prepared. It's just too complex of a science.
Mm-hmm. Well, where did you go from Fort Sam Houston?
From Fort Sam, I came up here to Fort Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
I was assigned to the 43rd General Hospital,
mm-hmm.
a brand new hospital that was just activated. I bet you I was about the 10th person to show up here. We drove up to the gate, and I asked the guard, I says, "Where's the 43rd General Hospital?" And he said, "I've never heard of it. Are you sure you're supposed to be here?" That was pretty scary.
Mm-hmm.
Moment of panic. It was a field hospital, which is a big hospital unit, but we had no equipment. We had no beds. We had no thermometers.
Mm-hmm.
We had an area assigned there at Fort Lewis that consisted of 6 or 8 of the big double barracks and all of the associated motor pools and that kind of stuff, but it wasn't a hospital. Someday we were supposed to be a field hospital,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't. It wasn't in the year that I was there.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to ask a question about your
sure.
AIT. What was the washout rate? How many people started in your class and how many people finished?
I don't remember the exact numbers, but there was probably 8 or 10. Well, maybe a quarter who didn't finish.
Any idea what was the hardest thing facing those individuals? Was there something consistently that people had a difficult time with?
The facts.
Okay, just memorization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we would have, weekly exams.
Yeah.
And if you failed 2 out of 3, you were out of there.
Okay.
Short, quick, and to the point. And then from there, you went to back down what they call to the bottom of the hill, where you learned to be a medic.
Oh.
An amazing sense of value to work.
Interesting.
Yes.
So the people who washed out of the lab tech
mm-hmm.
went down to become medics.
Right. So unless you wanted to be a medic, you pay attention to what they're telling you.
Yeah. But also, if you're on the infantry end of that, the medics that are being sent down for you are not the cream of the crop, so to speak.
No, they're not.
Okay. And these are the guys
that
are going
to... How do you feel about that?
Yeah, they're the ones that are supposed to be saving your life.
Yeah.
Okay.
But not all medics were guys who had crapped out in another program.
Right, right.
If, at that time, if you were drafted and you chose to be a conscientious objector,
mm-hmm.
you went to medic school.
Right.
People were drafted. If you scored at a certain level, you know, a level high enough to where you, you know, you're higher than what they needed for the motor pool,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't unheard of to end up as a medic.
Yeah.
So, but the kids that didn't make it through pharmacy school, X-ray school, dental school, lab school, all of those,
mm-hmm.
back down the hill to become medics.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway.
Well, while we're still on the subject of AIT, what
yeah.
was the atmosphere like there at Fort Sam Houston in the Houston area? Was there a good relationship between the military and the civilian community? You know, that kind of stuff.
No, it wasn't. It was an army town. At that time, San Antonio was a tough place. The Riverwalk that they have in San Antonio, I was there a couple of years ago. And, you know, it's all very touristy. At that time, the only time you went down to the river was if you wanted to do something that you didn't want the police see you doing. That's where you would go to pick up your drugs. That's where you go to get mugged. That's where you, you know, meet a girl on a street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, down by the river you could go. And it was pretty ugly. San Antonio was a very aggressive town. It was
mm-hmm.
it was fairly poor.
Mm-hmm.
Crime was fairly high. And then it was an army town, you know. The GIs would come to town, and what the locals wanted to do was to get their paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that worked. That was the way the system worked.
Right. You're calling it a town, but, of course, San Antonio is one of the largest cities in the United States. Was it at the time really kind of like a town to you guys, or was it more like a city?
Well, no, it was more like a town to us.
Interesting.
Because what we would do is we would go down to the bus stop and we'd say, hey, we want to go to San Antonio. And they'd
yeah.
say, well, get on that bus there. So that would take us to that part of town where the bars were, where the movie houses were. You know, it was just a little like San Diego. San Diego has, it's a beautiful city, but in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, there was a section of San Diego downtown which
mm-hmm.
was Navy Town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where all the sailors went. That's
yeah.
where all the Marines went.
Yeah.
And it was bars, and movie houses, and girly places. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's what I have in my mind.
Yeah.
We never saw the suburbs of San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
So I did when I went back this time,
mm-hmm.
but not at that time.
Okay.
So it was a town.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the rules about fraternizing on base? And of course, there at Fort Sam Houston, you've got a lot of men and women,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you've got the nurse. Isn't the nursing school there too?
Yep.
Yeah. So
yep.
you.
There was a big WAC attachment there as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was pretty frisky.
Interesting way of putting it. Yeah. What were the rules, or were there any rules?
Oh yeah, they told you, you know, no dating on the base. You know, you could see the women, and the women could of course see you. You couldn't go to their barracks; they couldn't come to yours.
Mm-hmm.
I remember all of the bushes surrounding the buildings were pruned very high.
Mm.
There weren't any low lying bushes close to the buildings.
Mm.
I remember seeing that and chuckling when it dawned on me as to why they were doing that. There was a lot of mixing. There was a lot of cars there. And so people would go tither and yon. And it was pretty frisky.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay.
But I, of course, was much too young and shy to be involved in that.
Yeah. Okay. If you say
anyway.
So. Was that for posterity or?
That's in case my wife ever reads it.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, so what was the going to Fort Lewis? What was it like compared to being around San Antonio at Fort Sam Houston?
It was just the next level of freedom, next level of responsibility.
Uh-huh.
I think I sometimes use freedom and responsibility interchangeably. You have the freedom to do more, but you're also held to a much higher level of responsibility. When I first came to Fort Lewis, this hospital we were in, I think I spent the first month as a typist, just because it gave me something to do, and I really did know how to type. Then from there, I transferred to the main post dispensary as temporary duty. And then I would go from there for a while, and then I would go up to Madigan Army Hospital, again, temporary duty. There was, and always, there was at that time and always has been a shortage of lab techs. So even though I didn't know much, I had the piece of paper that said that's what I was. So what they would do is they would pull us into the laboratories and they would start training us, actual OJT type of training, you know, to where when we were in school, we did two blood sugars, and that was what we did that day. Well, when you're actually working, at that time, you would end up doing 40 or 50 blood sugars and 20 liver enzymes and a couple of bilirubins and a bunch of stuff. We had a lot more responsibility. We were held to a higher level of performance.
Mm-hmm.
And we were free. You know, we had a life. When we finished our shift, we had a life. It was cool.
Yeah. Did you live on base there?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. What were the living conditions like? The quarters, the barracks?
Just that, open base.
Uh-huh.
And then what I did is I started working nights. And I worked nights because the guys who worked nights had the little rooms. So you got your own little private room so that you could sleep during the day.
Oh.
That worked good for me. So I'd work nights. I'd go to work at 11 o'clock and get off at 7 or 8, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't need much sleep. So I had a life.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my own private room.
All right.
Otherwise, they were just the traditional Army barracks with the open bays.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, anything interesting happen while you were there at Fort Lewis?
Oh, yeah. you know, just I did meet some guys who had gone to Vietnam.
Mm.
And had two guys, I remember, who had enlisted, like myself, for a three-year tour, RAs. And then they had gone to Vietnam shortly after training and came home, had enough time left to serve in the Army to where they were reassigned. And that was interesting because it took a lot of the fear away. You know where you're going. You don't have the great unknown. You know what it's going to be like. And these guys did talk. So like I said, it was calming. I remember that. It was very calming. So.
Okay. Let's see. As far as, I guess, the continuation of your training, you know, you mentioned earlier that your AIT was too short to really teach
Correct.
A lot of what your job would be. What were the more interesting and challenging aspects of your MOS that you came to learn while you were working at Fort Lewis?
I think the biggest was the hematology portion, where you're actually working with the red cells, the white cells, the cellular component of blood. That was neat because we had learned very, very basic hand methods for all of this type of testing. And then when we got to Fort Lewis, we found out that there were machines that could do this testing, the start of the technology that the clinical laboratory went through in the late 60s, early 70s. And so there were machines, and that was kind of neat. I liked that a lot because I enjoyed the science, but I also enjoyed the machines. So
uh-huh.
It was fun to learn that. I did do some bacteriology work at Fort Lewis that I had no training with. That was interesting to learn about the bacteria themselves. Again, we did no virology.
Mm-hmm.
There was none being done at Fort Lewis at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But the bacteriology that we were doing was basic stuff. So a lot of throat swabs looking for strep throat. Mm-hmm. A lot of wound cultures looking to see why it is that this wound is all puffy and what antibiotic is going to effectively treat it. So that was interesting. Again, we started learning different layers. Mm-hmm. It's like they teach you the upper layer. You know, this is it. This is the basics of what you're supposed to know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get to a real laboratory, you start going to the next level down, the next layer.
Mm-hmm.
So your knowledge increases. You get to where you can do more. You're more valuable. You're more able to stand alone.
Mm-hmm. Well, the technology that you mentioned, the machines that could start doing the analysis, were these machines new to the lab technician generally, or were they just new because you hadn't been exposed to them yet?
Both.
Okay. So the actual field was undergoing some interesting evolution.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I had mentioned the number of tests that we used to do.
Mm-hmm.
When I was at Madigan, which was a large Army hospital,
mm-hmm.
what I would do is I was working in the clinical chemistry section where I would do blood chemistries. And I would do, eight of this test and eight of these and 15 or 20 of these. And that would be a heavy day. I would be busy. And, the technology 5 years later could do 200 of each of those in an hour. The technology was changing that quickly. Because what we were doing is we were doing everything in test tubes. We were manipulating it all by hand. We were measuring minute quantities of this and quantities of that and boiling for 15 minutes and all this good stuff. And 5 years later, you took a half a mil, mixed it with a drop of serum, put it in a machine, and the machine read the change in color and converted it into glucose units, and there you were. Beep, write it down. So it was the changing in the field.
Mm-hmm. Any other specific changes that you remember in terms of new technologies that were making your job easier as a lab technician?
Let's see, chemistry. No. That was the big thing, was the chemistry and the hematology.
Okay.
And that's always been the bulk of clinical laboratory work anyway.
Yeah. Did you use a gas spectrometer?
No.
Ever? You just never used one in your military career?
Not in my military career.
Okay. Because that was new to the time period, too, correct?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That was magic.
Yeah.
Technology, man. That was magic.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what were the more important things that you took away from that 1 year at Fort Lewis before going to Vietnam?
I think it was confidence. You know, I went from knowing basically nothing to being able to very much stand on my own 2 feet and to be able to handle the workload, to know what it was required to be. You know, I was just confident in my ability to effectively work in a laboratory. That was the biggest thing.
Okay. And how much contact did you have with home?
Actually, I had quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, because my parents were living up here in Seattle,
uh-huh.
and Fort Lewis is like 50 miles south.
Okay.
So I'd see the parents a couple times per month. So it was pretty nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, never had to do my own laundry.
So. Okay. Let's see. And when did you find out that you were, after all, going to go to Vietnam?
I had been in Fort Lewis just about a little over a year. I got down there in March of 67, and June of 68 was when I got my orders.
Okay.
You know, it was a pretty much of a revolving door.
Mm-hmm.
Guys would come in, and they would, boom, back out the door they'd go.
Mm-hmm.
And almost always you didn't go to Germany, you didn't go to Korea, you went to Vietnam.
Yeah. Now, did you strongly suspect that eventually your number was going to come up?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there was no doubt in my mind.
Yeah.
Especially the fact that I was clinical arbitrary.
Yeah.
What they did is they tried to keep most of us stateside. almost no lab techs ever went directly from AIT to Vietnam. In our graduating class, which I don't remember, was, it seems to me, because there was two or three classes going on at the same time, that it may have been 100 guys, and maybe one or two got orders for Vietnam. Everybody else got orders for somewhere stateside to where they could train. And then we went up in rank pretty quickly. By the time I left to go to Vietnam, I was an E5. So, you know, you go up pretty quick because there are so many open spots.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I knew as soon as I got my E5, I thought, well, okay,
mm-hmm.
that's it.
Yeah.
And sure enough, within 2 months, I got my orders.
Mm-hmm. Now, over the course of that year and several months that you were there at Fort Lewis,
mm-hmm.
did you pay a little closer attention to what was happening in Vietnam? Did you come to a different understanding of what was going on over there?
Mm-hmm. I did. Yeah.
Can you elaborate a little on that?
Well, it was more real. It was more immediate. I never really, like I said, expected that I would end up crawling through the bush carrying a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really pay a lot of attention to the combat footage that was being shown on TV. I knew pretty much what I'd be doing when I got there. So, it became more real. And like I said, I had an opportunity to be around guys who had come home. And so they were informing us what our life would be like when we got there. And it was always a when, it wasn't an if.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you think the United States was trying to accomplish in Southeast Asia, before you went?
Yeah. What we were trying to do was stop communism. That was, at that particular time, that was the Cold War era. That was good guys and bad guys. We were the good guys and they were the bad guys. They were the evil red horde. They were going to come over here and kill us and eat our babies. You know, they wanted to bury us.
Mm-hmm.
One of the memories that I have of childhood is seeing Nikita Khrushchev on television or in a newspaper beating on a podium with his shoe saying, "We will bury you." And that's what I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's what we were being fed. You know, that's what they wanted us to think. It was our job, our goal was to stop the evil red horde.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I knew as a kid. So that's what we were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Was we were supposed to go over there and stop communism in Vietnam.
Did you ever begin to doubt that?
No.
At all while you were young?
No, not a bit.
Okay. How about later?
As an adult, yeah. Yeah. And by the time I got home, it wasn't so much that I was doubting the government. It's that I knew that the Vietnamese didn't want us to be there. The stories weren't holding true.
Mm.
They told us we were being invited in to save their country, and the Vietnamese weren't really all that happy to have us there. It was just, you know, just another bunch of soldiers. But I was very apolitical. I never really, you know, I was raised on a farm. What
mm-hmm.
do I know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. Well, what was the worst thing you heard about Vietnam and service in Vietnam from one of the guys that you met that came back before you went over? Do you remember?
The level of casualties. The description of what it's like to see somebody who has, you know, like 20 minutes ago stepped on a mine. The description of what it's like to, I'm trying to stay away from a cold, so I got a lot of stuff going up and down my throat.
Okay.
Anyway, but the description of what it was like to be in that medical environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's it like to see somebody come in who's only now all of a sudden got a leg and a half?
Mm-hmm.
What's it like to be sitting there and have a rocket come in and convert people to hamburger?
Mm.
You know, those were the stories that I was hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very real.
Yes, sir. Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe your last experiences stateside before going over to Vietnam. Did you get some leave time?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
What did you do?
Well, I was here in Seattle, here in Fort Lewis. So I came up and spent a couple of days with my family. It was very somber. My mother was tweaked. She had a real hard time with this. My dad didn't know what to do. He had no experience. He didn't know what I was going to go through. He didn't know what to say. He didn't know what he should say or do or think. So it was pretty somber, so I got out of there pretty quick. That was pretty boring. And, of course, it made me more fearful. So then I went down to Portland, where my one brother, who had been in the Air Force and was out, he was living in Portland. And I got to Portland just in time for what's called the Rose Festival. Every year in June they have a big festival where the ships come in and, oh, cool. And, yep, it's pretty big doings. So I spent a little bit of time there in Portland. That was fun. And then I went to California and saw my sister, and she was pretty twitchy. So that it wasn't fun, because what I was trying to do was I didn't want to spend 30 days saying goodbye to people like I would never see them again. Very good chance that's exactly what I would be doing, but, you know, I didn't want to do that. I'm a firm believer in denial. So then I went down to L.A. There was a friend I knew down there, met some people, went to San Diego, met some more people. A lot of pretty raucous living, a lot of drinking, a lot of partying, a lot of girls, just, you know, basically you don't know where you're going to be next year. You don't know even if you're going to get back. And that's a pretty scary thing for, I think by that time I was 21, so, you know, who knows what's going to happen next, so you might as well enjoy yourself now. So I did. I spent about a month just having a grand old time. And then from there I went back up to the Bay Area, because I was going to ship out from Oakland. So I went up to see my sister in San Jose. Oh, just a second. Okay. And, it was tough. People were not happy. I wasn't happy. I was scared. You know, they were scared. I was trying to keep a brave front and all this good stuff, all the stuff you're supposed to do. But we all knew that this was serious. So,
okay.
And then I went from there. I went to Oakland,
mm-hmm.
and got on a plane, and there you are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When did you leave, and what was the trip like over to Vietnam for you?
You know, I have almost no memory of the trip over. Just nothing.
Interesting.
I don't remember. I remember we stopped in Alaska. It was during the day. I think it was daylight almost the whole time we were on the plane. But I don't remember talking to anybody. I don't remember anything. I remember stopping in Alaska, looking
mm-hmm.
out the window saying, huh, looks pretty damn cold out there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all.
Whoa.
So my trip over was pretty non-eventful.
Yeah, yeah.
I was thinking about that the other day.
Mm-hmm.
Something had come up, and I was thinking, boy, I just don't remember any of that.
Okay.
So anyway, I do remember landing in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed on the plane. They refueled, and away we went. I remember landing in, what was the airport outside of Saigon? Tan Son Nhut. landed in Tansanute, and we all kind of stayed on the plane, and of course everybody was very nervous. You know, we didn't know what the hell we were getting into. We stayed there for a while. They opened up the door, and the heat and the smell were, of course, everybody remembers that. It was a world of difference from that air-conditioned air from 15,000 feet or 20,000 feet, whatever it is we had been breathing. Remember this officer type came on, and he had a 45 on, you know, he had his holster. And I remember looking at that pistol, and from where I was sitting, I could see that there was a clip in that weapon. And I knew that there were real bullets in that clip. And I knew that, you know, this was some serious shit. It had just gotten real serious. So I remember that. Then I remember that everybody zipped off the plane, walking on the tarmac, seeing the guys 100 yards away or whatever, how far away they were. They were yawking it up. Because they were going home, you know, they were done. Then I remember something about being in a barracks again, because I spent 2 or 3 days there. Remember the smells, lots of helicopters. Of course, you're scared. You think that any moment the bad guys are going to come ripping through the wire and kill y'all. We had heard a lot about rockets. We had heard a lot about bad guys everywhere. You never knew who to trust, and, you know, your best bet was to trust nobody. We had heard all the stories. We didn't know anything, but we had heard all the stories. And the smells, it was hot. Boy, it was hot. Man, it was. I remember sitting on my duffel bag thinking, Jesus Christ, I'm not going to be able to make it through this heat. I had just spent the last year and a half here in Seattle and wasn't quite used to the heat. So I spent a couple of days there. I was surprised at how stateside it was. At that time, the relocation battalion, whatever it was called, it was a huge base, and it was big. It was stateside. There were some Vietnamese civilians. First time I saw them, it was a little scary because I didn't know whether they were good guys or bad guys, and of course, you don't know anything, so you automatically assume the worst. You know, it's just, we were just rookies. We were new guys. We had no idea what the hell was going on. So that was my first impression. Mm-hmm. It was that it was getting serious.
What kind of briefings did you receive?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Not much, really.
Mm-hmm.
No in-country training.
Okay.
Like in the infantry units, they would take the guys to their place, and usually there was a training center associated with the battalion, and you got all your in-country training there. I went from Tansanute to Saigon. There was a place called the 9th Med Lab.
There oh, is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably seen it referred to before.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And all of the techs went there first. You spent, I think it was 2 weeks or a week or 10 days or however long, however much time they figure you needed to stay there, to where they could evaluate your skills and know where to send you. And so I spent some time there. This was shortly after Tet.
Yes, sir.
So Tet was in, what, January, February, somewhere?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. And this was July. I think I got in country July 8th or July 12th or something like that. So there was still pretty fresh stories to be told. And, of course, we're new guys. We get to tell all your stories over again. It's a wonderful system. There was one kid I knew that I had gone through advanced training with. I don't remember where he went, but we separated. And he was assigned to the 9th Med Lab there. And he was telling stories how they spent all of the first 48 hours up on the roof of this building and they were receiving fire. So he had some good war stories, and at the time I remember thinking, wow, this is indeed serious.
Yes, sir.
I don't know what I expected, but it was certainly serious. So then I just stayed there at the 9th Med Lab. I think I was there about a week. And then from there I was, they had decided that, yes, indeed, I wouldn't be a harm to my fellow man.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent me to the 85th Evac Hospital in Quinyon. Quinyon is on the coast. It's about halfway up the country. Nice place. Nice duty. I didn't know it at the time, but I found out later that it was great duty.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice place to be.
Okay.
It was an in-country R&R center for, I think, the 173rd. So it's pretty friendly little place to be.
Okay.
Ask me another question.
Yes, sir. Well, I was curious about the, the atmosphere there. You already mentioned that, of course, this is post-Tet, and a lot of things have occurred for that period, January, February, and into March. Then there was Mini-Tet later on, May of 68.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, politically, back in the United States, the effects of Tet were rather profound. How much of that did you hear about? Do you remember hearing about President Johnson deciding not to run for re-election?
Mm-hmm.
What was the atmosphere like, and did it meet your expectations?
I was very apolitical. I was naive. I saw the footage on TV. I heard Johnson's speech. I saw the kids in the street. I saw all of this, but I never really stopped to think about it. When you're playing cards and you get your cards dealt to you, you can't say, "Whoa, wait a minute, I want to do it over again." You just play the cards you have in your hand. And I felt that I had already received my cards. The hand that was dealt to me was the hand I had to play out. And I was totally apolitical. I had no knowledge that I had choices. I didn't even know that I had a choice of not going into the Army. I was raised to believe that that's what you did. When the government said, "Your job is to go here and do this," well, then, at that time, I thought that's what I was supposed to do. I was the perfect American citizen. I didn't really pay much attention to the politics, the rioting in the streets. There was a lot of black-white tension in that time. 68 was an amazing year, as we all know. And there was a lot of stuff going on. I was more concerned about the race issues and the rioting in the street than I was about the politics of Vietnam.
Okay.
Politics of Vietnam wasn't really my concern.
Okay. And how long did you stay at the 9th Med Lab?
I don't remember. It seems to me it was a week, might have been 2 weeks,
okay.
Might have been half a week.
Okay.
Not long.
Not long. And did they give you any special training that you remember?
A lot of work on parasitology, a lot of malaria. We had all had basic malaria, basic training in reading blood films looking for malaria, but you don't become proficient until you've done it many, many times. It's an art form.
Okay.
So we did a lot of training with that, spent a lot of time sitting at a microscope, a lot of work on intestinal parasites. The most commonly found parasites in Vietnam. We had slides of all of those different ova and parasites to look at.
Okay.
A lot of work on what we called emergency cross matching, basic cross match, where you would take the patient, the wounded guy, you'd take his blood and divide it into cells and serum,
mm-hmm.
the solid part and the liquid part.
Mm-hmm.
And mix it with the cells and serum from the donor bag and look for compatibility or incompatibility. So we all got crash course in that because that's a lot of what you did. And that's the training I remember from there. A lot of it was evaluation. You know, they wanted to make sure that, you know, if you needed to go someplace where you could receive a lot of training, that's where you went. Most of us went to larger hospitals, and then from there you'd go to a smaller. But a lot of it had to do with competence. Some guys who were just flat out good, they went directly to the smaller hospitals, where you needed somebody who had the experience to stand on their own and do this kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what was it like at the 85th Evacuation Hospital at Quinon?
In what way?
Well, in terms of good morale, the overall facility. You know, basically, what were your first impressions when you arrived?
Oh, I was pretty impressed. It was a very, very efficient hospital. Everybody was good. It was a big hospital. As an evacuation hospital, we would tend to get the guys from the aid stations or the smaller hospitals. We would do the more complex work there. In the smaller hospitals, you stabilize them and ship them, and you ship them to an evac hospital or a field hospital. So it was some pretty serious medicine. The laboratory itself was well-manned and well-equipped, as good as could be anyway, based upon the assets we had, which is mostly people. We were always short of people, so the usual shift was 12 and 12. You just, I was so amazed to find out that that was the shift. You were on for 12 hours and you were off for 12 hours, and plan on doing that for the next 365 days. And if we get a slack time, you know, you can take an afternoon off, but just plan on you're either working days or nights. The medicine itself, what we did was we were pretty isolated. We were back in the corner. We didn't have much fresh patient out of the field contact. It was a hospital, and you did hospital-type procedures. We did a lot of surgery there, so you do a lot of surgery workups. We had a lot of malaria cases, had a lot of what they used to call fever of unknown origin, guys who would catch something and just have these screaming fevers, but you never could put your finger on what it was. A lot of sick call, guys who'd come in with a bad appendix, things that you see in an 18 to 25-year-old population. You just worked in a hospital. There wasn't really much war going on. I was never rocketed. Nobody ever shot at me. We had some frisky stuff go on, but you know, you were not in a frontline unit. And what you were doing was hospital work. Most of the guys were, the morale was good. Everybody felt like they were doing something. I don't know about other units, but in hospitals, if you don't want to be there, you're not there. If you're not going to do your job, they get rid of you. There's too many places they can send you. So if you're not happy to be there, don't worry about it. You're not going to be there for long.
Mm-hmm.
They'll get rid of you. And so everybody was happy to be there, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The short guys, the guys who were getting pretty short, they were getting pretty wild. There was a lot of drinking went on. This was pretty heavy alcohol use. There was an enlisted man's club that was open 24 hours a day because we worked three shifts, or two shifts. Well, some groups worked three, we worked two. So you could get off work at 8 o'clock in the morning, go to the enlisted club, and all of the people that you had been working with that night be sitting there drinking. A lot of booze. And not just, let's have two beers and call it a night. You know, people were socking it away. There was a lot of escape going on.
Uh-huh. Was there much drug use?
Mm-mm. Not there, no. Excuse me, I'm eating a lifesaver. It's my only existence.
Okay. Did you not witness any, or it just...
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you could go into the... on base, there wasn't a lot, but Quinon was a medium-sized town. You know, there was There was a huge bar district. There was, the hospital itself was plunked down in the middle of this neighborhood, for lack of a better term. The village surrounded us. The hooch I was living in was a standard army barracks, two-story. You go out to the back deck, to the outside stairwell, and 10 yards in front of you is a big double-strand barbed wire fence with the, you know, the double-section fence with the concertina on the top and all that good stuff. A little row of sandbags, and then about 10 yards beyond the other side of that is the village. There's people living in, these were their huts. This is where they lived. So we were right smack in the middle of this neighborhood, for lack of a better term. We were in the Ville. So what we would do is that if you wanted to smoke dope or any of that stuff, you'd just go to the village. And you could get anything you wanted. That old Alice's restaurant. You know, you, if you wanted grass, you could get grass. If you wanted heroin, you could get heroin. I don't know. I was not into the drugs at all when I was at the 85th DeVac. Like I said, I did my more than my fair share of drinking. But I had no drugs there.
Okay.
And there was a quite a large pharmacy. And those guys, we knew that they were sampling their own stuff, but, you know, they were getting their work done. And, you know, that's their own ass if that's what they want to do. But like I said, if you wanted to go to the village, you'd go to, instead of going to this bar, you'd go to this bar.
Mm-hmm.
This bar over here happens to be a bar for white guys who like to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And this bar over here is for black guys who like to smoke dope. Or this bar over here is black guys who like to drink. And this bar over here is actually a whorehouse. And, you know, you knew what was what.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever you wanted, there was some place where you could find it. But there was drugs. Just, it was there.
Mm-hmm. Was there much self-segregation?
Yes, there was a lot. Sad but true, the bulk of the people working in the Army hospital, the people actually working in the hospital, were white. You know, that's just the way it was in 1968. I don't know if it was a factor of training. I don't know if it was a factor of selective assignment. But most of the guys working in the hospitals were white. Most of the cooks were black. Almost all of the guys working in the motor pool were black. There was open hostility. The first real live casualty I ever saw was a young black man who came in on a stretcher, and he was hanging his head over the end of the stretcher, and it was because he didn't have a jaw. He had been in town. He and his buddies were at their bar drinking. A white guy came into the bar, and words were exchanged. They beat him up and threw him out. So he went to the Jeep and grabbed his M79, and he lobbed around into the bar. This was one of the guys that got hit by it. That was, you learned where to go and where not to go. There was sections of the hooches, the barracks that we lived in. There were black barracks and there were white barracks. There were some to where people didn't much care, but the bulk of them were either or. There was some serious segregation going on. But this was a rare unit. This wasn't like the field where you're relying on the guy next to you to keep you alive. You might later on, somewhere on down the road, decide whether or not he's black, but
mm-hmm.
the big thing he's going to do is keep you alive.
Mm-hmm.
We were just a microcosm of what was going on in the United States at that time.
Yes, sir.
And that's just, you know, one of the things I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to be real honest. You know, my own bias will come through, whatever, but I'm just trying to be... I'm trying to answer your questions.
Oh, yes, sir.
Okay.
You're doing it very effectively. Thank you.
And please stop calling me, sir.
Okay. Good enough.
Okay.
What about Vietnamese people in the hospital area and in the base at Quy Nhon? Were there many Vietnamese people that came in, or was that not allowed?
there were some. We had a fair number of civilian employees. We had two civilian employees that worked in the laboratory, and they would do our glassware and clean pipettes, and, you know, just kind of keep the place tidy, that kind of stuff. They had a little bit of English, and we had a little bit of Vietnamese, but not enough for either of us to really get to know each other. So it was always very friendly. I always felt very comfortable around them. I think they felt comfortable around us. We always made a point to treat them with the respect they deserve. We had one new guy who was getting pretty... Yeah, he wasn't very nice. He was an arrogant little fart. Anyway, so... But the NCOs took him aside and said, no, we don't do that here. You know, that's not done. You treat these people with the respect that you expect them to treat you with. This is their country. We are guests. Behave as a guest. I remember that quite well. So there were civilians, but we didn't have the tools to really get to know each other.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yes, sir. Absolutely. Sure. And you mentioned earlier also that you never rocketed, you never mortared.
Correct.
And so, obviously, the Vietnamese that were working with you, it wasn't like they were supplying the enemy with information that would allow for more accurate attacks against you, things like that.
Right.
Was there a garrison there protecting the hospital?
Yeah.
Do you remember what unit it was?
We had a fair number of 173rds. Mm-hmm. The hospital itself sat on a little bubble of land that stuck out into the South China Sea.
Uh-huh.
And between this bubble of land and the main part of South Vietnam proper was a mountain range. And it wasn't very high. You know, none of the mountains there were that high, none of the coastal mountains. And that's where the Koreans lived. We had a rock unit that provided primary security for the town of Quinyan. And so that, I found out later, that's what kept it so quiet. The Koreans were... They were crazy. They were tough. You know, they'd just soon shoot you as look at you. And so it kept the town pretty safe.
Mm-hmm. Now, had you heard while you were there about the reputation that the Koreans had?
I learned it when I got there, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There was a working relationship between the Korean hospital and the U.S. hospital. And they had two lab guys that had been actually trained in the U.S., and so their English was wonderful. And mm-hmm. these guys would take us to their functions. If there was going to be a going-away party or whatever at the specific rock bar, I remember once being invited to one of these parties. Counted myself lucky to get out of life. They were tough. They were tough.
Yes, sir.
I remember these two guys were drunk, and so they decided to see who could hit the other one the hardest, so they just stood there and beat hell out of each other. you know, they were just nasty.
Mm-hmm.
There was a woman, a young woman, a Vietnamese, who was the bar girl. You know, halfway through the night, her shirt's ripped off, and she spent the rest of her shift, you know, waving her boobs. It was... It was a tough place, I mean. they were tough.
Yeah.
And during Tet, the VC had gotten into town, like they did into all towns, and had taken over the radio station, or the TV station. And so they were broadcasting from the TV station. And the Arvins went in, and they tried to get them out, but they couldn't get them out. The U.S. troops, I don't think... really ever tried to get them out, so they called in the Koreans. And the Koreans just drove a tank up in front of the building and just started firing and just literally blew the building to smithereens. Went in, drug out the dead VC, and hung them from the telephone pole. You know, and these were the people who were protecting us, which, you know, sounds good to me. So
absolutely.
Anyway, the Koreans were tough.
Mm-hmm.
And crazy.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Well, I guess what would be the most memorable first experience you had with a major evacuation coming in, you know, dust-offs arriving?
What we do is, this is where you first learn to hear the, to live by the helicopters. You know, you'd hear the helicopters coming in. We would be working in the lab, and the NCO would say, okay, it's your turn to go up to the ER. So we would send somebody up there to wait for the helicopter's arrival. And then what you'd do is they would pull them off of the helicopter on stretchers and right into the ER. And then we would basically just stand there, and somebody would hand us a tube of blood and say, go do your stuff. And that was my experience, was as an observer.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd hand you that tube, and you'd go on back and do your lab stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't really get much duty there. It was a sweet assignment.
Hmm.
Like I said, I didn't know it at the time.
Yeah.
But it was sweet.
Well, what was the most challenging aspect of your tour?
The most challenging aspect of that portion of my tour? Just bettering what I was doing. I was good when I got there. I was very, very capable. You know, I felt as if what I was doing was correct. I was doing my part. I was doing good work. But the more you learn, the more you know you don't. Did that make sense? Yeah, somewhat.
Yes, sir.
Anyway, I learned that there was a lot that I had to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So I became much better at working in a war-style hospital,
mm-hmm.
which is very different than a U.S. hospital. It's much more immediate.
Yes, sir.
I could do cross matches. I could do them fast, and you always do them correctly. You never, that's one thing you don't ever make a mistake on, because that will kill somebody.
Yes, sir.
So you always do them correctly, but, so then it comes down to, can you get it as fast as possible? And I got quite good at that. Malaria smears. You may mm-hmm. only see, on this slide that you're looking at, you may only see two cells that have the parasite in them. And you've got to see those two cells, identify that parasite so that the person can be treated with the appropriate medication.
Mm-hmm.
Because the different types of malaria require different medications, so you have to know which is which.
Okay.
You just improve. You just get better. And besides, you got nothing else to do anyway.
Yes, sir. <Yeah. laughs>
Right?
You're going to be there for a year, so.
Yeah, might as well.
Okay. Well, in terms of the new things that you might have been introduced to in country, did any of that involve new technologies that you had not yet been exposed to?
No.
Okay.
No, if anything, we went backwards technology-wise. We went way back to doing everything by hand. There was no automation. So.
Okay.
You just did it all by hand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what did you do for recreation?
Oh, in Quinyon, you'd get off, wrote a lot of letters, lots and lots of letters. Like I said, I drank pretty heavy. I got into a crowd where we would get off work, and then we'd just basically start drinking, and we'd get about 80% drunk, and then we'd go to bed and get up and do it all over again. So like I said, I was drinking a fair amount. I was probably drinking two or three times a week.
Okay.
There was a USO club that was open in the mornings. Most of the time I was in Quinyon, I worked nights because I was the new guy. And besides, I liked working nights. I like nights.
Okay.
You could go to this USO club and listen to music, play cards, read books, this kind of stuff. It was nice and air-conditioned.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hang around with a lot of people, so I stayed pretty quiet.
Okay. You mentioned that a lot of the drinking was escapism.
Yes.
What would you say was the thing people were escaping from most?
Fear, boredom, what you were doing during the day. You know, you take a 19-year-old, 20-year-old, 21-year-old who's never really seen death, and you know, it becomes an everyday thing. You see people who will never walk again. You see people who you know are going to get out of your hospital alive, but they're not going to live. You know that, you know, that leg is going, that person's not going to have a leg. That person will never see again.
Mm-hmm.
That person's going to die before the night's out. And then also the boredom. You know, all you do is 12 hours on, 12 hours off. And you, sometimes you just sit there and wait.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing to do. Other times you just run as fast as you can. Put out the call for the other guys and they'd come in and help. Or oftentimes they'd come get me out of bed and say, hey, you need to come back to work. You know, it's just too busy. We can't handle that. We need help. And so you'd go back to work.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all you did was work and not work. So, what a bore. And then it's scary shit. You know, you got your hands in somebody's body.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, so that's what we did.
Do you, do you remember any particular times where the demands increased significantly? Like, for instance, I know you were in country in 1969 during the Battle for Hamburger Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember those types of events?
Hold on for just one second.
Yes, certainly.
From July of 68
mm-hmm.
till December of 68,
mm-hmm.
I was in Quinyon. And that was a large hospital in a pretty good-sized little town and very secure area right on the beach. You could go look at the beach anytime you wanted. And then after December, we moved up north to a place called Fubai.
Oh, yes, sir. Why?
Okay, yeah, you got mm-hmm. it. And then I was in Fubai maybe a month, less than a month, 2 weeks, and I got transferred to the 18th Surgical Hospital in a place called Camp Evans.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about 10 miles south of Kuang Tri.
Mm-hmm.
And so it went from day on the beach to, yeah, some pretty serious stuff. And there it was possible to see the daily response to something like Hamburger Hill, the assault in the Asia, all of these things,
yes, sir.
Battles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you would get, you know, these 2 and 3 day mass casualty situations where you work for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just do. Come by and get a little shot of this,
mm-hmm.
have a couple of vitamins, and, you know. But that was a different world.
Yes, sir.
I was in two different worlds the time that I was there.
Okay.
So I got an idea. Let's finish with Quinyon, and then we'll do Camp Evans next time.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes, sir. I was just going to ask if you wanted to do that.
I think that's an excellent idea.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Let me go ahead and put an official end to this.
Okay.
This will end the first interview. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. This is Steve Maxter, continuing the interview with Mr. James Calbreath on the 19th of December, 2001, at approximately 10:45. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Calbreath is in Bothell, Washington. Sir, why don't we go ahead and pick up with a discussion of your move from Quinyon to Hue Fubai, and if you would just talk about the change there. What unit you were now assigned to, or if it was the same unit, just moved, and what it was like there at Hue Fubai.
Okay. When we were in Quinyon, the hospital itself was very insulated from the rest of the country. We were on the coast. We had a nice little mountain range between us and the rest of the country, and there were an awful lot of Korean troops in the mountain range. Basically, what that meant was that Quinyon was a very safe area. It was very secure. Right around this time of year, in 1968, just before Christmas, I think it was, the hospital, lock, stock, and barrel, moved from Quinyon to Fubai, which is very close to Hue, and we were next to a military airfield. The hospital itself was very much in the same degree of safety, shall we say. buildings themselves were much the same. It was a good-sized evacuation hospital. Evac hospitals by nature are not usually too close to the mud, shall we say. They tend to be in larger camps, a little bit insulated from what's going on. Flew by, the biggest thing I remember about that was that we were next to this airport. And day and night there was planes taking off, landing, taking off, landing. It wasn't a jet field where you had the big jet transports or anything like that. It was all props. But dust was continually flying, and it was that red dust that everybody talks about. So no matter what you do, the first thing you had to do was wipe the dust off. I know for our particular type of work, dust was deadly. So we spent a lot of time battling the dust. I was in Fubai for maybe 3 weeks, and at the end of that time, I was transferred to the 18th Surgical Hospital, a small hospital in a place called Camp Evans. Camp Evans was about 10 miles south of Quang Tri. It was considered the Army's far northern hospital. It was a world of difference. In the past, I had been in these places that were very insulated. Now, all of a sudden, 50 yards from where I slept, maybe 100 yards, was the wire. And from there was, it was the Northern Ireland. It was a frisky little place. Lots of rockets, mortars. It was a world of difference. Have I rambled on a lot? Have I raised a question?
Yes, sir. Well, were there any other concerns? You mentioned that dust was a constant concern, I guess, as a contaminant.
Correct.
Were there any other concerns in that context as far as just that were specific to the geography or environment of Hoi Phu Bai or Vietnam generally?
No, not really.
Okay.
No, nothing comes to mind.
Okay.
Many of these memories. 30-plus years old.
Oh, I know. I'm asking a lot.
Okay.
when you moved to Camp Evans, about how many people were in that vicinity in terms of the field hospital? What was the actual size of the base there?
The field hospital itself, we had about, I think there was 40 or 50 staffers. The patient population was just continually up and down. We had three wards, and a ward would hold maybe 24, 25 patients. And our big business was the ER. We would, the helicopters would come in. So what that did is that filled those wards up, and then the wards emptied out quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Because the surgical hospital, their idea was to stabilize. We didn't keep people until they were...
Mm-hmm.
ready to go back to the field or to be shipped out. What we did is we'd bring them in and we would stabilize. Lots and lots of surgery. Lots and lots of emergency medicine. And then we would ship them to an evacuation hospital.
Mm-hmm.
At an evacuation hospital, if they needed further surgery, they received it there. If a person just needed a couple of weeks of basically R&R to get over a minor injury, they got that there. And then they were either shipped back to their unit or another hospital up the line or to someplace like Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So the hospital itself was pretty small. Camp Evans wasn't a very big base, but it was fair size.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like a fire base or anything like that where they just carved off the top of the hillside. That wasn't what it was. It was a fair size base. But we, like I said, were pretty close to the outer edge. Again, I think every decent-sized base in Vietnam had an airfield, and the airplanes were continually coming and going.
So
I look back over some of the snapshots that I had taken at about 12,360 pictures of airplanes taking off or landing, and at least an equal number of helicopter pictures.
Okay.
Anyway, another story altogether.
Well, we... Were you in the hospital? Did you carry personal weapons? Were you armed?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Nope. Never at any of the hospitals were we armed.
Okay.
We had access to weapons.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people had, they'd come up with a pistol someplace and they'd shove it under their bed. So there were some personal arms. But as medics, the common story and the true understanding is we just probably just as likely kill each other as kill any bad guys. That was in the larger hospitals. When we got to Camp Evans, you did keep your weapon in your locker next to where you slept. So we were armed there. But of course, because it's unsafe medical personnel generally to have access to loaded weapons,
mm-hmm.
all of the ammunition was stored away from us. So we had these lovely rifles, but no bullets.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know how that goes. Looked good. We looked good.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very ineffective.
Okay. Now, about what time did you arrive there at Camp Evans? Do you remember?
I arrived at Camp Evans middle of January. I remember that because it was my birthday.
Okay.
Happy birthday to you.
Uh-huh.
You're now going from a pretty nice place to someplace that's not very nice.
Yes, sir. Okay. And, oh, and just to verify, that's early January of 67.
69.
Oh, I'm sorry, 69.
Yeah, did I say 60?
No. I you didn't say any year. 1969.
Oh, okay.
Gotcha. What major combat units shared the base with you? Do you remember?
Mm-hmm. This was mostly support of the 101st.
That's right.
I believe it was 101st, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The 1st Cav had built the facility.
Mm-hmm.
Camp Evans was originally the headquarters site for the Cav. The Cav left, and I think they went into 2 Corps, possibly 3 Corps.
Mm-hmm.
The 101st came in and took over the area.
Mm-hmm.
Much of the 101st was, of course, at Camp Eagle, which was down on the other side of the way.
Mm-hmm.
But there was still quite a presence there.
Right.
Camp Evans had a lot of helicopters, had a lot of artillery. It was much of a support-type base. And as such, we had, like I said, a lot of helicopters, a lot of artillery units. There was a fair number of infantry that was housed, stationed, whatever, right there at Evans.
Okay.
Evans also had a huge ammo depot.
Mm-hmm.
There's many stories of somebody setting it on fire, satchel charge, misplaced rocket, whatever the story happens to be. But I guess it went off and created quite a light show. That was prior to my arrival.
Okay.
I just remember walking along and you would find an awful lot of shells just laying on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Small arms. The big stuff that had come by picked up. A lot of bullets.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
Okay. Well, how frequently was the base rocketed or mortared while you were there?
Actually, quite a bit. And by quite a bit, I define as not something like caisson in those days.
Mm-hmm.
We would get hit, 3-4 times a week, sometimes a couple times per day. And it was like just enough to keep your attention.
Mm-hmm.
There were never intense barrages. But you would just be walking along, standing around, and you would hear that very, very short sound, and all of a sudden there was a large explosion.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be a couple of rounds. It might be 10 or 15.
Mm-hmm.
Might be one.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you'd do is you'd just crawl along in the dirt for a while, kind of wait and see, because rarely did they send in a couple and wait and then send in some more and then wait. Usually what they would do is they would set everything up, blast like crazy, and run through the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of your incoming would take place very quickly. So if you got on the ground fast enough, managed to stay there, you'd be okay because it was, like I said, very short.
Mm-hmm.
But intense. Very intense.
Yeah, how effective was the rocketing and mortaring in terms of, you know, did they hit the targets they were seemingly aiming at? Were there many casualties?
No, it was more just throw it into the base somewhere. The hospital was set up in such a way that there was an airfield, a little bit of open space, the hospital, and then everything else surrounded us. What they would do is they would just throw stuff in hopes of hitting the airfield or something of value. And we would occasionally, you know, they would land in the compound in our area. I had gone on a trip, came back, laid down, woke up in the morning, looked up, and there was a hole in my roof. And the building I was in had a little, had a brand new hole that occurred while I was gone. You know, they would just hit. It wasn't like they were aiming at anything. They were just throwing stuff in and see what kind of trouble they could create.
Okay. How about snipers or small arms fire?
A couple of times there were attacks on the wire. Not on our perimeter, not in our area, but there were, I remember, two actual assaults on the wire. But remember, we were a good-sized base.
Mm-hmm.
It would take a huge number of people to effectively overrun that base or to get in and create any real problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was more just knock, knock, you know, we're still here, pay attention. That kind of thing. But there were two occasions. And lots and lots of fire, incoming fire, went on for I don't remember how long.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was it. But there were no snipers. There wasn't anybody shooting at us from the other side of the line.
Okay. Now, how would you evaluate the facilities there? And by that I mean both the lab that you worked in and also the hospital facility itself.
It was pretty yahoo sticky. The facility itself was pretty basic. You know, it was a surgical hospital. Our job was to get them off the helicopters, get them into surgery, and get them on to the next hospital. The facility itself was good. It was a must unit. Medical unit, semi-transportable. And what they had was we had basically inflatable quantities. They would lay everything out, plug it into an air compressor, and the quantities themselves would inflate. It was the most amazing thing you ever saw. And then the lab, pharmacy, x-ray, those facilities would be in trailers. And so you'd drive the trailer up, secure it in place, fold the sides down, and everything would slide out. The original double wides, I think, is what they were. They weren't as long as a regular trailer. They were more square than anything, maybe 10-foot square. And everything that we had would go into that trailer. And when they said semi-transportable, they were serious. We could be on the road and out of there within 12 hours. But I had never experienced that. That happened before and after my time.
Mm-hmm.
The facility itself was well stocked, but like I said, very basic.
Mm-hmm.
In the laboratory, we did a lot of basic stuff, a lot of cross-match. We did a lot of work with fresh blood.
Mm-hmm.
When you get somebody in who was pretty bad shape, that was one of the first things they always needed was blood.
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of blood. So we had a good setup to where we could transfuse very effectively. We could monitor patients. It was a surgical hospital, but that meant there was a lot of down and dirty medicine.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was to, they're almost dead, stabilize them. And we did a lot of that.
Okay.
So the hospital itself, outside the laboratory, we had a x-ray facility, so they could do all of that. We had two or three ORs and very good staff, very good surgeons. You do a lot of, like I said, down dirty stuff. Everybody does everything.
Mm.
In the past hospitals I had been in, we were very limited on what we would do. helicopters would land, and you know, the first two or three guys standing around would grab a stretcher, and out you'd go. You'd load these guys physically from the helicopters to the stretchers, mm-hmm. and then you would grab the stretcher and into the ER, RNE, whatever it is. And then everybody would do whatever they had to do.
Mm-hmm.
People developed their own specialties. My specialty was cutdowns. When a person is severely injured, they're in shock, they've lost a lot of blood, the veins all get very small.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to get a decent-sized needle into a vein that mm-hmm. can support blood.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're delivering blood, you want to use as big a needle as possible and get it in there as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So what had happened was you couldn't get into a vein. I had been drawing blood for years and years, and that's quite effective at it. But with somebody who's severely injured like that, you can't find the veins. So what I'd do is I'd do cutdowns, and I would surgically go into the inside of the arm and you know where the veins and arteries are supposed to be, so you just kind of start cutting until you come across one. And then you open that vein up, insert a needle, stitch it in place, throw a couple of stitches in to hold everything in place, open it up, and start throwing blood into it. That was one of my specialties. But you just do everything.
Where did you receive training to do that kind of work?
On the job.
Did one of the surgeons? Pardon?
How's that for your confidence level?
Pretty good. Did one of the surgeons help train you, teach you how to do that? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Because you kind of stand there, and you know what you need. What do you need me to do?
Yeah.
And somebody would say, okay, take this and do that.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual cut downs themselves, I think I was trained twice. I had worked with a surgeon. He
mm-hmm.
showed me how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I think he showed me again and then watched me do it. And then he said, hey, you're pretty good. Okay, that's your new job.
Wow.
And that's what I would do.
Mm-hmm.
I did, I don't remember how many I did, but by the time I left, I was quite proficient.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the first time I ever did it on my own, I was pretty cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Not near as fast as the last time I ever did. But, you know, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And you develop into little teams. And when you're in a team like that, everybody kind of knows the little things that need doing,
mm-hmm.
and you do them.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'd do is I would do that. I had experience with early CPR. We actually had an occasion where we did internal cardiac massage,
mm-hmm.
meaning they cut this guy's chest open, put on a glove, and massaged his heart to keep him beating.
Mm-hmm.
It was rather amazing. But you do whatever you have to do. So you stand there, and, you know, today you might be doing cut downs, tomorrow you might be debriding a wound and doing some suturing. The next day you might just be cutting somebody's clothes off. You know, you just do whatever has to be done.
Right.
And then pretty quick, somebody hands you a tube, and they say, you know, we need 5 units type specific. So you would run over next door to the lab, and you would do the cross match, and you would grab a couple of compatible units, and you'd bring them back to the OR, slap them onto the... we used a pneumatic infuser, which is just a little bag you pump up. Puts the blood bag under a lot of pressure,
mm-hmm.
squirts blood into their arm.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you would do. Yeah.
How long would it take you to cross match?
Oh, I don't remember. It'd probably take about 20, 25 minutes. Most of these, all of these guys were young.
Mm-hmm.
You know, almost none of them had ever had a transfusion before. So there really wasn't much incompatibility that you would have to deal with, because the difficulty with cross-matching is that if the recipient has a lot of very strange antibodies,
mm-hmm.
and you get these antibodies from a bad transfusion in the past, an incomplete transfusion, where the blood almost matched but not quite.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like an allergic reaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know how you get stung by a bee the first time, it doesn't bother you?
Right.
Second time, it makes you quite sick.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with prostate. Mm-hmm. You can't give somebody, you can't give an A a B-type blood, but there are a number of different levels of A-type blood. And if those are incompatible on the lower levels, you develop antibodies. And when you're starting to do this cross-match, you find those antibodies, and then you have to scratch that unit and start a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember it ever taking a really long time.
Yeah. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but there is one blood type that is considered the universal donor, correct?
Mm-hmm.
How much of that did you keep on hand?
We kept a lot of that on hand.
So that way you wouldn't have to worry immediately about cross-matching.
Correct. That was the ideally it would be an O negative, but you couldn't keep much of that because there wasn't much of that.
Okay.
So we kept an awful lot of O positive and figured that 85% of the population is type-specific Rh positive.
Mm-hmm.
And O basically means you have none of the... means you're not an A, you're not a B, you're an O.
Right.
O is lacking. So what you could do is you could slap O positive onto that patient and be very secure that they're not going to have a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Some people who have reactions today, or now let me back up. Some of the people who received that blood then will have reactions today.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, you know, this was their first ever. This was their first ever time they'd ever received blood.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, biologically speaking, the deck was stacked in our favor.
Right.
So a lot of O positive.
Okay.
What I'd do is I had two big refrigerators, not as big as you'd see in a Safeway, but big by our standards. And I had, I think, four shelves on that refrigerator. And three out of the four would be O positive. And then there was a fair amount of A's and a little bit of B and AB. We just didn't get. We just never got any AB.
Okay.
It was actually a good system because what would happen when the kids would come into Fort Lewis for their basic training, first thing they would do is invite them to donate blood.
Mm-hmm.
So the kids at Fort Lewis who were coming there for their training would donate blood. It would be packed up, and it would be within our hands within 5 days.
Wow.
4 days, something like that. It was a good system.
So were you ever short of blood?
No. Nope. Because we were a surgical hospital, we had first call.
Okay.
And, you know, all I ever had to do was ask the radio guy to call down to Saigon and say, hey, I needed such and such.
Mm-hmm.
We tried not to keep an excess of blood,
mm-hmm.
but it's hard to judge. You don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And when people would say, okay, we're going to, we're planning a big outing into such and such an area,
mm-hmm.
what they do is they would let us know a week in advance. And so we would have all of our stocks in place prior to them making this big outing someplace.
Yep.
Into the Asia.
Mm-hmm. When you say all of your stock in place, do you mean you would order additional blood?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. I probably kept, at any one time, I had 100 units. Most of it all positive. So.
And if they were going to go out on an operation, would you have more than 100 units?
Occasionally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or if it was, we were there for the, when they had gone into the Asia.
Yes. For Hamburger Hill.
Oh, yeah. You got it. And at that time, we kept, I don't remember how many units of blood, but we would go through, you know, we'd go through blood like it was water.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing to put 12 to 15 units into one patient.
Wow.
Nothing. Other times you might put one. I think the most I ever saw was 40.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever... Oh, I'm sorry, one last question about blood.
Sure.
Did you ever have a patient react to it?
No.
Okay.
Never did.
Wow.
Yeah, I was quite happy with it. Because you... That's the nature of lab. You have to do it correctly every time.
Mm-hmm.
Period. And so I was always very proud, very happy that I had never even had a, a minor reaction.
Yes, sir. Did you witness the triage process there when during heightened periods?
Oh, yeah.
What do you remember of that?
That was, let me put it this way. My heartbeat just went up about 40 points.
Okay.
That was tough. That was tough, tough stuff. What you'd do is that you'd get the helicopters coming in, and if they came in one, go out, bring them in, no problem. Now all of a sudden, you start getting more helicopters, and you could feel them. You really couldn't hear them so much. I remember feeling the helicopters. They would shake the, you'd feel it because it's such a low sound, a low noise. You'd feel it versus actually hearing it. And then you could tell the way they were coming in. You could tell how hot their delivery was going to be. I remember one occasion going out to pick up somebody off the helicopter and looking back towards the hills and just see them lined up. You just probably 5-6 birds just lined up. As far as you could see, there was one little speck on the horizon and you knew he was coming your way. So what you would do is that you would now shift your teams. What we had was maybe 4 teams, and we would decide on who was be treated next. It was very godlike. You would have somebody come in who had, I remember one kid came in and he had a little cut in the middle of his forehead. The downside was that little cut happened to be a piece of metal that had gone into his brain. And watching the surgeon stick his finger in this guy's head up to about the final knuckle and saying, I can't even feel it. There's nothing we're going to do. So we're going to set this kid to the back of the ward. And we'd take him and put him in the back of the room, literally. And they would just sit there and wait for him to die because there was nothing we could do. There was no place we could send him where he was going to get the care that would save his life. And we knew that. When times were tough and things were hot, you had them lined up. If you had a very, very severe case, you couldn't work on that person because the time that you spent working on that person said that the other 3 moderately injured whose lives you were going to save, you wouldn't save those 3 because you wasted all that time on that one, setting aside and letting die. Hardest thing, because we were all at some level, we were all there to save lives. That's what we did. And to take somebody and set him to the back of the room and say, bummer, you're going to have a really, really bad day just because the numbers are stacking up against you. So what you do is you would just stand there at the door and you'd say, okay, put him on table 1 and put him on table 2. And, this guy, he can wait because he needs a little suturing. Somebody get to that when he can. And so you would just stand there and do that. I remember doing that once. I don't remember the occasion. I don't remember why I was doing it and the surgeon wasn't, but I do remember. And at the time, you're just working. You're thinking. You're doing what has to be done. It becomes pretty automatic. I don't remember why I ended up doing this, but I do remember that I did it. Luckily, it was nobody that had to be set aside. I didn't have to make that decision, but that was in my mind. There was a fear that I was going to have to do that. And I was kind of myself lucky that the one time I did it, I didn't have to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
That's some serious shit. You're setting that person aside to die.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to remember that. And I can still remember the face. I can look at the eyes. I can still see the eyes. And you know that there's nothing you can do. And they know that there's nothing that's going to be done. And it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. But, got two choices. You can look on the negatives or you can look on the positives.
Right.
We saved a hell of a lot of lives. And we had to let some people die to do that. But not by choice.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember about how many times that had to happen?
No.
Okay.
But not in the 10s and 20s, nothing like that. I remember maybe.
A handful.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it wasn't a daily occurrence.
Right.
Because on a daily occurrence, we had staff, we had facilities to handle the casualties.
Mm-hmm.
But when things got really nasty, when things got really hot,
mm-hmm.
You just couldn't keep up.
Right.
We used to have what's called mass casualty situations, mass counts. And you would work for two or three days just as fast as you could go.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you'd just about get this one squared away, and you'd hear they'd come. So you just kind of get back up on your horse and go again.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see the first episode of China Beach?
I'm sorry, what?
There was a TV program called...
Oh, China Beach.
Yeah.
I saw a couple of episodes. I don't know if I saw the first one.
Okay. It was pretty tough. I didn't hardly watch the first episode because I had heard about this. And I thought, that's kind of, you know, Hollywood meets Vietnam. And so I wanted to see what they did. And so I think it opens with Dana Delaney walking through this empty ward. Everything's real quiet, kind of dark. And she's walking alone, and she's looking at all the different stations. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, that's pretty accurate. Yeah, somebody helped designing that.
Mm-hmm.
And going along, and then all of a sudden she walks to the back door, and you can see the doors vibrate. And she throws the door open, and here's a helicopter up. And the noise of the helicopter and the red dust in the air and the bright sunshine. And you look at her face, and she says, okay, deep breath, and go get them again.
Mm.
And that's what you do, is you just take a deep breath and you say, okay, let's do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So the bulk of the time, we didn't have to do that. I remember three occasions. Two three-dayers and one two-dayer.
Mm-hmm.
But you just do that. That's what you do.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about Hamburger Hill?
Hamburger Hill was 3 days, just kind of a hazy little area. The helicopters would come, and you may have 2 minutes between helicopters. You may have 2 or 3 hours between helicopters. Lots and lots of patients. We set dash aside during Hamburger Hill,
mm-hmm.
just because there were too many coming and not enough people.
Mm-hmm.
Then when things would settle down, when you got the criticals done, then you would start working on the patients that were just injured, needed
mm-hmm.
care, but they weren't critical.
Mm-hmm.
I was working on one kid's hand. He had a real bad abscess. He got a piece of wood in his hand. And so he was working, I was working on his hand, and
mm-hmm.
I was, it was ugly. It was all pussy and yucky. It was yucky.
Yeah.
Let's use that term. So I was literally in there degreeting, draining it out, just tending to this hand.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy says, aren't you ever going to look up at my face? And I thought, I don't have time. I'm busy. But I do look up, and here's a kid I'd gone to junior high with.
Oh, for Colonel Lowe.
Yeah. Just, actually, he was my one of my better friends in junior high school.
Huh.
So anyway, you just...
yeah.
It all becomes kind of a haze.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of haze, man. It's just, you know, severely wounded people, mildly wounded people, amputations, sucking chest wounds, what I remember mostly is the traumatic amputations. Because when you're walking along and you step on a landmine, it takes your right foot, runs it about halfway up what used to be your shin, and then the frag comes across and removes your left foot. So what you have is you have a compression and a traumatic amputation. That I remember as being the most... that was the toughest one. Those were ugly. You knew that this person had yesterday, they were thinking, gee, I remember when I was in high school and I was a safety on the football team. And maybe I'm going to do something like that when I get back. And today they're going to be in a wheelchair the rest of their lives. You think of that in a brief second, but you see, you look and you think, well, you know, yeah, we're going to lose this much of this leg and that, you know, that much of that leg's gone. How many units of blood is this going to take? You start looking at the face, you look at the color and decide whether or not they've got enough blood in their system to establish an IV in their arm or hand, or are you going to have to cut down? Can you do this one and still save the other two who are back? You just start making these real quick choices, and they become surprisingly automatic. It's like any job. You know, you just get to where you know what has to be done in the first 30 seconds. I think the biggest thing I remember about Hamburger Hill was basically that it was just a haze. It was just a really, really busy time. Lots of people. So, there you go.
How much longer did you have in country after Hamburger Hill?
Not long. That's part of what made it bad. Hamburger Hill was, May? June? Somewhere along in there. And I rotated out the 1st of July.
Okay.
So I remember being tired.
Yeah.
You know, I was just drained.
Yeah.
By the time Hamburger Hill was a tough one because it was tough. Around that period, there were some big things that went on. That was a pretty frisky time in that area. We had a bunch of reservists come in who had gotten chewed up by artillery. That was pretty bad.
Were these friendly casualties?
Friendly fire.
Friendly fire.
Yep. We had, I don't remember the details. I don't want to say anything without remembering the exact details. But basically what it was is we had a bunch of guys come in who were reservists. They didn't tell people where they were. There was a reserve artillery unit who didn't know where people were. And you know, as oftentimes happens there, nobody intentionally did anything wrong. It was just wrong thing happened to the wrong people at the wrong time in the wrong place.
Yes, sir.
So you just line them up and away you go. That was tough. Because from where I was, Vietnam was waste. All I saw was the waste. I saw these young kids coming in who would never walk again. I saw these young guys coming in who were dead and they didn't. All I saw was waste. And then to have, you know, be working 12, 18, 20 hours on this group of guys and find out that they were injured by U.S. That one was a tough one. That one brought a lot of bad dreams. So that was what I remembered was the waste.
What was the principal coping mechanism employed by you and other people that served in that unit to deal with that kind of emotional stress?
Are you going to use my real name?
Oh, well, yeah, this is on the record.
Oh, yeah. Now, what we did is at Camp Evans, there were basically three groups of people. There were the drunks, and that was mostly the NCOs. And the officers, a lot of drinking. Then there was the dopers, a lot of smoking dope. There wasn't any hard, there was no heroin, nothing like that. Smoked a lot of dope, just grass. And then there were the Seventh-day Adventists, who didn't do anything but sit in their booches, you know, write letters, read, this kind of stuff. The primary coping was the way young people always go, is to get loaded and forget about it.
Yes,
take that little mini two-hour vacation, because in four or five more hours or 2 minutes, you're going to be back to it again. So, and then the nice thing about what's the nice thing about the There is no nice side to that. Mm. That's what we did, mm-hmm. is did that, so you'd have hooches. And there was usually, six, eight guys to a hooch. And this was a smoking hooch, and this was a drinking hooch. Mm-hmm. This was a Seventh-day Adventist hooch.
Gotcha.
And that's what you did. And then so we would sit down and have us beer, smoke us a little dope, then we'd play cards, then we'd listen to the radio a little bit,
mm-hmm.
then you'd go to bed. So that was the primary way that we could.
Did the command just turn a blind eye to the marijuana use?
Yeah.
Okay.
They would come through and sweep occasionally, and, once a month, and say, you're not supposed to.
Mm.
Confiscate pipes, whatever. But mm-hmm. Nobody was ever arrested. Nobody was ever given an Article 15, because usually when the officers would come through, the word would spread through the camp in about 12 and a half seconds, and everybody put everything away.
Okay.
They knew what was going
on. Yeah.
And so, they were coping in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what we did. But you take a bunch of, the average age of the hospital was a little older than what you would see amongst the grunts, the regular army.
Mm-hmm.
Regular army was about 19, maybe 20. And most of us were over 21. And that couple of years makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a lot of bullshit. Everybody just pretty much did whatever we did. If you felt like you had to smoke a little dope, and you could still, most importantly, you could still be ready to go when called upon.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody said that. If you were drinking so heavy, or if you were smoking so heavy that you weren't ready to stand up when the bell rang, then you were in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And we had people that we got rid of because they were drinking too much or smoking too much.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just what you did.
Okay.
You had a bunch of young kids. And we're all doing the best we can. And mm-hmm. if we need that little two-hour R&R, then you take it.
Yes, sir. Well, from where you stood,
mm-hmm.
was there anything that they could have done better at the 18th Surgical Field Hospital? Or did they do everything that was humanly possible?
No, I think we did. I would like to have seen more laboratory support.
Mm-hmm.
But where I always felt like we fell down is that we couldn't do anything other than basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We could tell how much blood the person needed. We could tell whether or not they had an infection going. But if they were heading south and we needed to do blood tests such as electrolytes, sodium, potassium, chloride, CO2. We couldn't do that because we didn't have the hands, we didn't have the equipment, we never had the opportunity to set it up.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't prepared for that. But remember, we were a down and dirty organization.
Mm-hmm.
So it was bloody stuff. That's the one thing I would like to have seen, is the ability to do the more advanced stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But we never had the time, material, training
mm-hmm.
to set up and do ourselves.
Okay.
Nowadays, when a hospital receives, nowadays the laboratory is very available.
Mm-hmm.
Just about everything you need is there. But at that time, the technology wasn't there.
Okay.
We needed things like glass pyramids. That's what I would like to have seen.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The staff themselves were good. The attitude of the staff was quite good. Morale was never high because you're doing some ugly stuff.
Yeah.
When they talk about, you see the movie MASH and everybody's sitting around laughing and having a grand old time. I don't remember a lot of laughing.
Mm.
I remember a lot of silliness, but not really laughing, not really humor. You try, but you can't. You just can't.
Mm-hmm.
But, everybody did it. Good they could do.
This will end CD number one of the interview with Mr. James Calbreth. This is CD number two of the interview with Mr. James Calbreth, continuing on the 19th of December 2001. Why don't you go ahead and describe what it was like for you leaving Vietnam?
Oh, that's a good idea. Okay, I left Vietnam, left Camp Evans in early July 1969. Went from there down to, I think, Nang, or maybe from there down to Cameron. It was a little hazy. All I knew was I was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Went down there. When I first went to Da Nang, spent the night there, and I remember that was probably one of the most miserable nights of my life, because we were in transit, so they sent us to the transit barracks, and the transit barracks was just kind of an open hoots that had a bunch of bunks in there. Of course, we were tired. I had worked right up to leave the day before. I was up to my elbows. Like I said, tiredness was a big thing for me. I was just wiped out. So I had gone to the transit barracks, and, well, maybe I might have partied a little bit the night before. But you know how that goes. I was tired.
Mm-hmm.
Went to this transit barracks, and all I wanted to do was lay down and sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So they assigned me to a bunk, and I laid down on this bunk, and there were 12 million flies that descended upon me. So I went up to the kid who was supposedly in charge of this, and I said, hey, you know, can I get a mosquito net or something like that? And he said, no, actually, all we have are these wool blankets. So it was probably 100 plus degrees. Laid back down on this bunk and covered myself up with a wool blanket to keep flies out of my face. So you have to leave an opening, and the flies would just, you know, the flies would come in through that opening. So you couldn't sleep, couldn't breathe. Finally, I remember getting up and just walking around for the most of probably all afternoon. And once it got dark, I knew the flies would go away. So just about the time it got dark, I went back, laid down with my wool blanket, and Vietnam never really cooled down all that much at night. So it was still pretty hot and sweaty.
Mm-hmm.
The flies went home and the mosquitoes came out. I was on my way home, so the last thing in this world I wanted was contact with mosquitoes.
Yes.
I spent a lot of my time doing malaria scares,
mm-hmm.
and working on kids that had malaria. I was deathly afraid of malaria. I had taken all the meds and all the pills, but I knew those weren't 100% successful. So I couldn't sleep in this place because it's the same thing. You're covered up in a wool blanket, you sweat, now it's probably down to about 90 degrees. And the little hole that you leave yourself to breathe through is where the mosquitoes are coming in. Any exposed flesh, they're going to glom on. And every time I would feel a mosquito bite, I would just wake up in this absolute panic because I was sure that I was going to get malaria my last night in country. So I got up, walked around another part of the night, remember catching about an hour's sleep in the front seat of a Jeep somewhere. I was down by the boat pool because it stunk so bad of oil and gasoline that the mosquitoes would come around. So that was good. So I finally got a couple nights sleep. Next morning, another airplane, Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Cameron. And went in, spent about, 4 or 5 hours filling out papers, standing in line. Right place, right time. They said, hey, we've got 10 seats on this plane that's going out in an hour. First 10 people that are up here are the winners, and I think I might have run over at least 3 people getting up there. So anyway, I spent a very short period of time there, got on the airplane. The airplane took off. I remember watching the country descend. Everybody was holding their breath. They were sure that they were going to get killed their last moments in country.
Mm-hmm.
Just an amazing catharsis, just this cheer that went up when the plane was what we consider far enough off the ground to be safe. All of my energy, all of my thought, all of my being had been to get me to this point. And now what I had done is I had succeeded. I had
live through it. We were in the air. We were off the ground. It was what I had. It was the culmination of my life up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
It was that strong of a feeling. And then the pharmacist had given me this little red pill to take because I told him I wanted to get some serious sleep in. So I took this little red pill and the rest of it took a bit of a haze.
Mm-hmm.
I felt pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I remember getting off the plane in Tokyo and walking around and then getting back on the plane. And I remember waking up just as I felt the airplane start to descend coming into the corn up here in Washington.
Wow.
But then to look out the window, feel the plane start to descend.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, any time over here, you know, all you see coming in is clouds. But we went into the clouds, we came out of the clouds, and there it was.
Mm-hmm.
You could see the airport. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It was, like I said, that was the sum total of what I had set out to do, was to survive Vietnam, and I had done it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a great sense of relief. And I didn't feel, anything other than relief. You know, I was happy. I was ready to be done. And then I came back here to Fort Lewis, which was where I had been. Prior to going to Vietnam, I was stationed at Fort Lewis. One of the things that we did is that we used to work be occasionally assigned to the physical line to do physicals on people coming off from Vietnam prior to their release. So a year later, I'm walking through the physical line.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of a treat. I kind of like that. There were still some people there that I knew.
Mm.
But, of course, the Army is, they run people through pretty quick.
Well, yeah.
You know, 2 or 3 year tours of duty for mostly enlisted. So you can change people. Pretty good turnover real quick.
Mm-hmm.
There was a couple of people I still knew. So that was kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I never really liked being in the Army. I found that I didn't have a mean, vindictive side, but I had a very subtle, vindictive side. Never harmed anybody, but definitely got my points in. There was a bunch of us standing outside, and this was, like I said, early July. And around here, summer doesn't start until the middle of July.
Mm-hmm.
So it was cold, and it was wet, and it was rainy. And we had just spent the last year in a very hot climate. Now all of a sudden we're standing there. I don't remember if we were still in jungle fatigues or not. I don't remember the uniform that we were in. But the second lieutenant type walks up to the front of the line because he's an officer. He doesn't have any badges. He hadn't been overseas, so he cuts in front of the line because he's a lieutenant and walks in. And what they had you do is you took off your shirt and your T-shirt and you folded it. You set it very neatly on the floor on the square that you were standing in. Then you put your hat on top of that. And then you kept your pants and boots on, and you went through this physical line. As we went in and lined up, and people told us what to do, I looked over, and here was this lieutenant's shirt, hat, and it was just sitting there on the floor next to mine. And so I reached down, and I took all of his brass off. I took the little bar off his hat. I took the little bar off his collar. I took the other little bar off of his collar. And so now, all of a sudden, instead of being an officer, he was a private E-1. And Fort Lewis, at that time, had an awful lot of basic training. And they were slick slaves. They had no mark of rank. Now, all of a sudden, this guy didn't either. I probably shouldn't tell you that. That was kind of like my final thing that I did.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow that seemed to appease my sense of right.
Okay.
Like I said, that was my idea of getting even.
Mm-hmm.
I felt pretty good after that.
okay.
Sorry, but that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went to the airport and got on the plane there in SeaTac and sat down next to this guy who was also just coming home.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we just didn't have anything to say. You know, there was just nothing to talk about. Yeah. Because everything that we had wanted to do, we had done, which was to get out of Vietnam and get home.
Mm-hmm.
And got off the plane there in San Diego, and my family was there to greet me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I thought that was it, man. Mm-hmm. It was, my life was complete. I was done.
Mm-hmm.
Little did I know that I had a few more years to live.
Mm-hmm.
More things to do.
Yes, sir. Well, when you were when you first arrived in the United States, and then as you went, you finished your processing through Fort Lewis and went to SeaTac and then traveled a little bit more in the country, did you encounter any kind of anger or hostility towards Vietnam veterans, towards yourself?
No. You know, there's the stories you always hear about the hippies waiting at the airport spitting on you. No, that never happened. I never saw it.
Okay.
I remember that there was the first example of what I would... It wasn't really... They weren't mean to us, but you could sure see they were afraid of us. You know, there was fear.
Mm.
People just... Because we had our uniforms on, we were, you know, all sunburned and tanned. And, there was no doubt where we had been and what we'd been doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there was fear. People stepped away. Through my life, I learned that was the norm.
Mm-hmm.
People step away.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first I'd ever seen it. I couldn't figure out what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think looking back, I recognized what it was. But at the time, I didn't know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew that, they're not too excited to see me. So, you know, just... That's what I felt. I didn't.
Yeah.
There was none of the spitting, chanting.
Okay.
That makes good stories, but I can sign.
Well, how much longer did you have in the Army when you got back?
None.
That was it. You're finished.
That was it.
Okay.
Yep.
What? No, sorry, go ahead.
Nothing.
Okay. What were the important things you took away from your experience in Vietnam and Southeast Asia?
Personally?
Yes, sir.
I think it was a sense of strength. Physically, I was never, and still I'm not, a Charles Atlas type, but I have a personal strength. When things start going goofy, I can remain calm.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, you know, once they've shot at you, it's hard to get too excited about a water main break. A sense of strength, the ability to respond rationally in a risky environment, that was probably one of the big things. A good sense of self. I think I always had a good sense of self. This reinforced that for me. You know, I like me. I kind of always have. Vietnam did not take that away from me. It did add to that for me. Because I had survived a very, very difficult situation. I was proud of having survived it. I felt like I gave a lot back to the service and the men who came through the hospital. That's probably the biggest thing. And then, you know, just don't get too excited. When my daughter was approaching college age, I tried to explain to her the concept that if they're not shooting at you, it really doesn't matter. And I found that was something that I had been carrying around that was just a fairly alien concept. She finally understood what I was talking about, has developed some of that into her own personality. But it was interesting to see that she didn't. That was not an intuitive concept. I think that's the biggest thing.
Okay. What did you think as the war wound down and then the United States withdrew in 73 and then Saigon fell in 75?
I was pissed. You know, just flat out pissed. Remember I said one of the things for me was a sense of waste. What I saw is I had spent a year doing the best I could to to save lives, to save limbs, keep people alive. And we had worked hard at that. We had given everything that we could possibly give to save people's lives. And then what the government did, what the American public did, is that we walked away from it. We threw up our hands and said, I'm tired of this. And as well, we should have been tired of it. But anyway, what they did is they basically walked away. I went into an absolute tirade one of the few times that my wife left the area. I had come home from work. The TV was on. And I remember watching them pushing helicopters off the side of the secretary. Okay. I remember them watching them pushing helicopters off the sides of these fucking aircraft carriers. And I was just livid. I went into absolute tirade. I threw things. I went out in the driveway and I yelled at the top of my voice. And I mean, I was having a little tizzy fit. And I felt much better afterwards, I might add. But at the time, I was pissed. Because the thing for me was a sense of rights. Everything that we had done, all of those lives, all of those limbs, all of that was because they walked away. So, and believe it or not, there's still a little hostility there as a set of Vikings.
Well, what do you think about the current U.S. policy normalizing relations to Vietnam?
That's fine. It's time. Most of the people that we dealt with there are gone. The current North Vietnamese regime, you know, that's the way it is. We walked away and handed it to them, and if I were walking down the street and saw a $20 bill sitting there, I'd pick it up. So I don't really hold them responsible for what we as a nation did. Like I said, I consider that we as a nation just got tired, washed our hands, and walked away. And the North Vietnamese said, hey, look at this. And they came down and they said, okay, we'll take over this country. And we were not there to stop them. So they just walked in. Establishing normal relations at this time, that's fine. You know, it's no problem.
What do you think? I'm sorry?
I figure holding a grudge for 30 years is
not
long.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering what you thought we as a nation should take away from our collective wartime experience.
Either do it or don't do it. That's the biggest thing. What you have to do, anytime you decide to pick up a gun and chase somebody, you better plan on killing them. You don't pick up a gun and chase them and then say, well, yeah, I'm kind of tired of chasing this guy, I'm done. Because he's going to come back and he's going to shoot you. Because once you pull that gun out of your pocket, you change the rules. And it's like what we're faced with right now in Afghanistan. I'm not a supporter of the Republican concept of how we all should live our lives. I'm not a supporter of George Bush, but I'm a supporter of the concept. We have picked up a gun and we've said, you can't do that. And so now what we have to do is we have to go all the way. We have to hunt them down and shoot. Because if we carry our guns around for a while and wave them in the air and say, don't you dare do that again, and then turn around and walk away and turn on the TV, they're going to come back and get us. And, you know, the commitment has been made. Now, I think that's the biggest thing that we have to do. Yeah, I sound like such a crap. Anyway.
No, well, I understand your example there.
Okay.
One of the things we did in Vietnam was we did withdraw.
Yes.
And without securing our goal.
Yeah, exactly. We gave.
Okay. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about today?
a little bit on what it was actually like to live as a veteran.
Okay.
When I got home, I went to San Diego and started school at a local junior college down there. And there was a huge, huge difference between the kids that were there having just come out of high school or had been out of high school for a year or two and those of us who were veterans. You could walk into a class, you could walk into a room, and, you know, any of us could pick the other out. You know, you'd look around that room, and second and a half, you knew who were veterans and who weren't. We all tended to do the same thing, and that was to try to fit in. We had come back from a world that they had no concept to, but we had come back to their world.
Mm-hmm.
We had to fit into what was going on there because they sure as hell weren't going to change what they were doing for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's only logical. So it was a sense of isolation. What I did is I found that I never denied being a veteran, but I wouldn't bring it up. Let's just say you tend to just kind of put your head down and keep your head down and go along. What that did is that all of the feelings, all of the stuff that you had experienced, all of the anger that you had, all of the words that you had in you that you needed to get out, you didn't have the opportunity to get those words out.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what I expected. I don't know what I would have done differently. But I do know that there was this great sense of loss because what had happened is that I had spent 3 years in the Army. Now, that's 3 years. But I had changed. I had so drastically changed that today I don't know anyone that I knew prior to going to Vietnam, excluding, of course, Ben. And then my family all lives in California, and I live in Washington. So there's quite a separation between the family and us. We're not really very close.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was a direct result of Vietnam or not, but you know, I was the only one that went over, and they're down there, and I'm up here. So maybe it had something to do with it. But basically, there's that sense of loss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you lose some of your childhood. You lose an awful lot of your innocence. So there's some hostility there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the biggest thing. I think that's the only other thing that I would add. It's hard to come home.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to talk about your experiences at all with your family members?
Nope.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was it just something they didn't want to talk about?
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were uncomfortable.
Okay.
Because when I had come home, I changed.
Yeah.
I was not the same little redheaded boy that had gone over, and they didn't know how to deal with it. And I knew that I had changed. I was different. There's no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were uncomfortable. And then our family's never been real good at talking things out anyway.
Okay. All right.
Ready?
Yes, sir. Well, is there anything else?
No, sir.
All right, well, let me go ahead and put an official end to the interview. Thank you very much. This will end the interview with Mr. James Kelber.